This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of July 12th, 2021, brought to you by First Person Advisors, a subsidiary of NFP. I'm your host, Mason King.
Here we go. Antron Brown drives away 3.752, 325 miles an hour.
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Most folks know or could safely assume that Indianapolis is the nation's capital for open-wheel style IndyCar racing. But Central Indiana also is home to big players in other motorsports. Don Schumacher Racing, one of the elite teams at the highest level of drag racing, is headquartered in Brownsburg. Schumacher's drivers include three-time Top Fuel world champion Antron Brown, who lives nearby in Pittsburgh. He won his titles in 2012, 2015, and 2016. He's 45 years old. He's still racing at a high level, and he is in the process now of founding his own racing team. He will roll out AB Motorsports in 2022 as both owner and driver. Now, it might not seem unusual for a longtime driver to want to own his own team. This is a bit out of the ordinary in that Antron, who is black, will be one of the few black owners ever in the 70-year history of the National Hot Rod Association, and certainly the first in the modern era of Top Fuel or funny car racing. Now, as Antron points out in our interview for this week's edition of the podcast, drag racing historically has been more diverse than other forms of motorsports. His father and his uncle were what they call sportsman drag racers on the weekends. And in our interview, we discuss his desire to be a role model for young people who wouldn't necessarily think of motorsports as a career. We also discuss what it takes to be a great drag racer and what he expects it will take to be a great owner. Here's our conversation. It is my pleasure to welcome to the IBJ Podcast, Antron Brown, three-time National Hot Rod Association Top Fuel champion. Thank you so much for making time today.
Oh, Mason, anytime, anytime. It just feels good just to, you know, talking about a little bit about motorsports here back in the home country of Indiana, back here in Indianapolis, and a place that I grew up, not grew up at, but I've been living here, and my kids have grown up here their entire lives since 2001.
Let me ask you just right off the bat, because I've never been in a drag racing car. I'm sure most of our listeners have not been in a drag racing car. Can you describe the sensation of going from 0 to 325 in 3 seconds? Like what happens to your body?
The crazy part of it is everybody always thinks about the mile an hour. So we're different than NASCAR, IndyCar, F1, where, you know, they get up to speed. They don't take from a dead standstill, okay? And maybe F1 does. They might be on the grid. They're on the grid when they take off. So, but us, we're at a dead standstill and we just accelerate. Like, our sport is all about G-forces. And what I mean by G-forces, we take off and we pull close to 6 G's in a straight line. So to put it in everybody's mindset so they can understand, it's literally like saying you're sitting at a stoplight and then a school bus doing 100 miles an hour just comes up from behind you and hits you in the tail end and they snap you. That's what a Top Fuel car is like taking off the starting line. It's controlled chaos. It puts your whole body and your mindset through like a trauma. If you've ever been in a car accident, that's what it feels like going down a deal. Not, you know, crashing side to side, of course. But what I mean is where everything happens, even though it's happening really, really fast, is it sends your mind in that trauma state where it goes boom. And then it's like, hold it in slow motion, but you can see where you want to go, and where you're seeing is crystal clear, but all your peripheral around you is blurred away because you're just getting like sucked in and pulled right to it, like right to the 1,000-foot mark. And that's one of the best ways that I can describe it, because honestly, there's nothing on this planet that does what a nitro car does. Not a pro mod car, not a bracket racing dragster, a pro stock car, pro stock motorcycle, not a jet plane being catapulted off an aircraft carrier. None of them accelerates like we do. We literally accelerate from 0 to 100 miles an hour in 0.8 of a second.
Like, okay, so you're different. I'm guessing like your internal organs feel like they get displaced.
Yeah.
Like your stomach is like in your spine.
You're shaking, absolutely. You'll feel it, like you literally feel your stomach like it touches your backbone. It's like somebody's like compressing you, like trying to push the air out you, and you feel it. You just go, And the craziest part is, if you ever saw an in-car camera of us on the race car, when we get to half track, and half track, like I'm saying, like 550 feet, is where the clutch goes one-to-one, where we pull the most Gs. We pull 6 Gs at 550 feet, like halfway down the racetrack, because it's where the clutch finally goes one-to-one, and it locks up the 12,000 horsepower. We pull more Gs when we're at 290 miles an hour than we did from 0 to 100 miles an hour. Like, we pull about 3.8 when we leave the starting line, like, boom, because it doesn't, the car doesn't have all of its power to it, and we're slipping the clutch. And then as the car keeps going, we're just giving it more clutch, and we're feeding the power in. Because if not, it won't be able to keep the tires hooked up.
Now, what are you as a driver expected to do? What does a great driver do in those like 4 seconds?
What a great driver does is that they're able to bring that same level game every time. They're able to replicate what they do each and every round. Okay. So what I mean by that is to leave on time, having a good reaction time, and to leave before your other competitor. And then also they're trying to navigate this car down the racetrack. But this is the thing, before we even get to that point, a good driver has to initiate how they trim their fuel pumps, how long they do their burnout, how they back the car up, because all that stuff goes into the run. If you don't do the burnout long enough, or if you do it too long, you overheat the tires. You do it too short, tires not heated enough. Then when you're backing the car off, car back up, if you're on and off the clutch, you're heating the clutch up. So then you're making the clutch more aggressive, or it's getting to the point where it's swelling up from the heat, where it's too close together, where it makes it act different, makes it more aggressive. Then you got to worry about that. And then on the same point, you want to make sure you get the fuel pumps trimmed right, so the air fuel ratio is right in the engine. So maybe you got the car too hot, where it gets too lean when you step on the gas, or you got it too cold because it's not trimmed right, and you make the car drop a hole. So when you're a driver, you got to kind of keep everything the same every time.
So, I mean, a lot of it is preparation and just continual perfection.
Yes. You win the races by what you do back at the shop and what you do in the pits with all the crew guys all working together. And you can have a great crew chief, a great driver, but a so-so team, you'll have so-so results. You have to have everybody on the same page, everybody pulling that rope together equally as hard as equally as strong to get that result that you want. And you can't have no weak links. Everything's got to be strong.
So what is it that you have enjoyed about this in the more than 10 years? It's probably almost going on 15 years that you've been drag racing.
I've been drag racing in Top Fuel. This is my 14th year in Top Fuel. But before I raced Top Fuel, I had a 10-year career in Pro Stock Motorcycle. So this is my 24th season being a professional drag racer of sorts. I've been around sport for a lot of years. Been through it where I owned my own team when I used to race motorcycles to racing for Don Schumacher, racing motorcycles underneath the U.S. Army banner, and then also going into racing Top Fuel and doing what I'm doing. So
you just, I mean, describe what you do for a living as like being like trauma. Why do you like getting back into the car every time?
When you get into a Top Fuel car, funny car, or Top Fuel dragster, it's kind of the sense when you're getting in there for once, there's 10 people on the team, including the driver. You're getting back in there and it's a team sport. And when you, and as a driver, when you sit in there, it's like you're the gladiator. You get what I mean? You're going to battle with these other teams and they want to take you down, plain and simple. You know what I mean? Layman term, I mean, in like old world terms, they want to take your head off is what they really want to do, right? So when you go out there, it is so awesome to compete at that level. And like, you're never plateauing. You're always trying to evolve and to move forward. And that's the coolest thing about it, is to push yourself to those extents.
So is this a step into ownership kind of like the next bit of evolution for you then? I mean, to take yourself into, you know, a new area that you can compete in?
Well, I think for me, I think the next step of ownership is just one of those deals where you get to control your own destiny, where you want to go, how you want to go, and also open up other doors and opportunities for other people to come in. You know, I mean, I know for me, when I came into sport, I knew how hard it was to get in. And for me, I see a lot of kids and students of the game that's coming up and people that want to be out here, that want to do it, but they don't know how to get there, or it's not people that's having that out there for them to get in. And I want to be that bridge. I want to be that bridge and say, hey, I see this person here that has the same passion and fire in their soul, in their eyes that I had when I was that age, and say, hey, let's see what you really have and bring them over and maybe give them an internship or give them a place on a team and let them work and see if they can grow up and build up and we can develop them in something like that. You know what I mean? Like for me, it was trial and error where I just put myself out and around it and got opportunities where it took me years to get to where I'm at. You know what I mean? It took me over 7 years to get opportunity to even test a top fuel car, let alone become a driver of one. I just want to be able to, hopefully I could bridge that gap and make those time frames a little less and reward people that put that work in, because that's how our sport grows. You know what I mean? Like Don Schumacher, I mean, if I wanted to keep on doing the same thing where I'm at a great place to win championships and do a whole bunch of stuff. But the thing about it is that in life, I feel you never grow unless you get yourself uncomfortable. You got to get yourself uncomfortable. Well, I've been in a comfortable position for the last 8 years of my career. And then at the end of the day, Don, he loves racing, and his daughter, Megan, she loves it. They're in it. But at the end of the day, you look at people like Don, 76 years old, John Force, 74 years old or somewhere around there. Connie Coletta is in his 80s, who owns teams. We need more newer team owners, because we need more people that's going to take that torch on and keep this going when they're not here. You know, I didn't want to wait to where I get into the age where I'm just a team owner. I like to be a team owner and build upon that and grow it while I'm still driving also too. It was just a deal that I always planned on, not just like with the last year or 2 years. This has been a goal of mine for the last 6 or 7 years.
All right, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
One size does not fit all. Your employees demand a flexible benefits program. Meet them where they are with Improvement, a reimbursement benefit that finally makes sense for your people. Learn how it works at firstpersonadvisors.com/perks.
Okay, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. Our guest this week is NHRA Top Fuel drag racing champion Antron Brown, who is in the process of creating his own racing team, which will be headquartered in Brownsburg.
Was there a particular moment that kind of tipped you over to deciding, now I'm going to make this happen?
No, it was just timing. I thought it could happen a year earlier, but COVID hit. And that slowed everything down, of course. And I've been working on different plans back and forth with Don Schumacher for a while now on it. You know what I mean? Where I could buy his parts and pieces. And I've been pretty much job shadowing for the last 10 years. Like everything he does, it's like, oh, okay, Don does it like this. Oh, he does it like that. You know, and I look at other people the way they run their race teams. Like John Force, oh, he does it like this. And like when I used to race for David Powers, he did it like this. Mike Ashley did it like this. This wasn't like this. And I look at all the different teams and I've been like just observing them and saying, what do they do great? Okay. Both these race teams and this race team over here, they win championships. That's great. But why does this race team have more turnover over here? And this one here doesn't have turnover, but they win more. And why does this one over here, like, you know, they're up and down and all over the place where they barely make ends meet. Then this one over here, you know what I mean? It's like they spend a lot, but but they tear up a lot, but they don't go nowhere. You get what I mean? It's like, so I observe so many different teams from afar, and I'm looking at them and I'm trying to choose and pick and saying, let's take the best of each world. What makes, what did each team do differently, but what did they do great differently?
What does it mean to you to be one of the only Black majority owners in the Motorsport Series? And really, I think one of the first in modern era of drag racing.
To me, it's a dream for me, period. This is something that I'm always been goal-oriented and always never like to sit idle, where I'm always pushing to the next phase. And if it's something for me where it can inspire others, that's what it's all about. If others can say, hey, man, like, we can do this too. AB's doing it, because I'm no different than anybody else. It's just that you just got to be willing to put that work in and put that time in and sacrifice. And you got to be all in. It's plain and simple. And it's not that, you know, it's a right way or a wrong way to do it. No matter, I don't care who you are, you're going to make mistakes. But when you make those mistakes, that's what you're learning from.
Now, you live in Pittsburgh, and then your team is going to be based in Brownsburg. Is that right?
Yes.
What is that going to look like? Are you going to have like your own facility?
Yeah, like in time, what we're going to do right now, the plan is right now, DSR, Don Schumacher Racing, he's in about 140,000 square foot building right now. And they're all sectioned off. Bob Tasca, who's he races for Ford Motor Company, funny car team, he has a section of building that he rents that he's off to his own. I'll have my section in a building that I rent and I'm off to my own. You know what I mean? Until one day, like, you know, as I see fit, if, you know what I mean? I like to build my own race shop down the road somewhere. You know what I mean? That's the ultimate game plan, is to build a building, not as big as Schumacher's, but maybe something like, because our race team, we only really need for like a 2-car team down the road. We have a 1-car team, but a 2-car team, you only need about 10,000 square feet. But my goal is to build like a 40,000 square foot building and maybe have some other bays that you could lease off to other teams. And do some other stuff like that, you know, or partners that want to utilize some different space like that, or just rent some space out. And then if you ever grow to a 3-car team, you just move and take more of that building away.
How big is a team? How many people will you employ?
Like a single team like mine, right off the bat, I can see that we're going to probably have about 12 full-time employees. And then we'll have some probably about 4 part-time employees too.
Can you share a little bit about what kind of financial commitment does that require from you to be able to start one of these teams?
I can tell you this right now, when you start a race team, you're looking at probably, it depends on what level you want to do it on, to be honest with you. You get what I mean? There's so many different levels that people do it on, but if you want to do it like a top tier team, to start off just with parts and pieces, transporters and everything, and just to get the deal rolling, is at least about a $2 million investment, at least to get going. And in a year's time to run a fuel team, I want to say you're looking about at least $4 million to $5 million. Some teams doing on $5 million a year, $4 million, you could do it logistically, but it depends on how you do it. And I mean, I'm talking about all in, but then you have some teams that could do it on 3, and you got some teams that could do it on 3.5. And it depends on how they have all their stuff structured, or it could be some teams that's been out there for a while where they do it. I know I saw some teams do it on 2.2, but they're not ones that are running for championships. You know what I mean? They're not out there racing to win, and they don't have they don't have the right personnel. They don't do it with 10 people on a team. They might do it with 7 people on a team. And it just all depends on how you want to race. But if you want to go out there and compete at a high level, for sure, the minimum you need is $3.5 million.
And what are you looking at? What do you think your budget's going to be?
My budget, hopefully, we'll be up there in the higher echelons. Between the 4 to 5 is what we're shooting for to get to. And we have a lot of great partners that we're trying to bring on board. And hopefully one day we could work on enough, like, you know, a couple new partners that's outside this industry that we could bring aboard, that we could do a second car and bring in some new talent, another talented driver. And that's the goal for AB Motorsports, is to honestly find some more partners to bring aboard that we could do a second car.
So, I mean, sponsorships is a big deal. I mean, that sounds like a big part of what you would be involved in.
Oh, absolutely. I'm always a go-getter. I'm the one that goes out and builds relationships, and that's going to be part of our marketing side on the business side.
So, and one of the things that I know you're really good at is like making relationships with fans and, you know, being really generous with your time with fans. If you're an owner, are you going to have time to do that same stuff?
Oh, that stuff won't change. I'm going to have more time now because I'm going to have somebody else working on a car mixing the fuel that I used to do. Hey, you boys need to take care of them. We'll take care of these people out here. But I still, like, you know, I used to always mix fuel and be out front mixing fuel. And it gave me some time where I couldn't just do stuff like that, you know. So now I can spend a little bit more time with the fans and the people at the racetrack. We're at the racetrack. That's what we're there for. Like, we're a representative and a spokesperson for all of our partners and sponsors that we represent. And I still, for me, when I came into sport, that was what's so special about the sport. That's how I got into it, is by being able to see and talk to all the people who I always looked up to all my heroes in this sport. And that's what made NHRA drag racing so special, is all the access. Like, there's no special ticket to get a pit pass. Every ticket gives you all access. And when I grew up as a kid, my dad used to take me and walk me around, see the pit steel, work around their cars, get autographs, sign my hats, our t-shirts. And then when they just let you come in the pit, and one of the guys let me sit in their cars, I was like, I want to do this one day. And then when I found out you can get paid to drive a race car, I was like, I'm all in. That's all I thought about when I was 12 years old. I was like, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that you can be an inspiration to, you know, like, diverse young fans, is that really important for you, especially to go out and find diverse job candidates, people that you could bring into your organization?
I think that's just important everywhere. You know what I mean? The most important thing for us in motorsports is when we get to go, and I get to do a lot in the YES program, Youth Educational Service through NHRA. We go talk at schools. I've been to St. Louis with Flojo, Jackie Jordan Kersey's program, and where we got to go to inner city kids. And not just to recruit them, it's just to open our eyes and show them the other opportunities that are out there. They're like, hey, I never thought about having a job working on a race car. So we go talk at the Lincoln Techs, the Western Techs, and all the different OTC and Rankin Tech here in St. Louis, all the technical colleges are out there that are giving 2-year degrees, and now they're giving bachelor's degrees at these colleges that you go to, because they'll teach some business classes mixed in with the, you know, with the, basically with the hands-on training technical side of it, where now they can go directly into their own type of, like, if they want to have a mechanic shop, they can have a mechanic shop, but not just know how to work on the cars, but also how to run their business. When we go to these schools and I see all these different, like, these students in there, these young adults and teenagers, and I'm like, hey, we got opportunities for you out here. You know what I mean? And you see them, whether Hispanic, African-American, Asian-American, because they don't know about the opportunity that motorsports has. And then when I see other people of color that look like me, and they go, there's a brother, not just out there racing, but racing and winning championships. Like, I sat on the floor of Madison Square Garden with my championship ring on, which is a really big, it's like a Super Bowl ring. Amazing. And I was sitting on the floor, and I never forget, me and my brother's there, and I was doing a New York car show, and Chris Rock was sitting right next to me. The comedian Chris Rock, that's on all the TV shows and movies, sitting right next to me. He looked at me, he goes, man, you don't look big enough to be a football player. He said, but you could play. You got a little build on you. Then he looked at me and goes, now I know you ain't playing basketball. My size. Like, so I'm 5'9". You know what I mean? And then I told him, I said, no, man, I'm a professional drag racer. He goes, brothers do that? I'm going, yeah, we always did. It's like drag racing was always a diverse sport because there's drag races everywhere, tracks everywhere. You know what I mean? It's way different than circle track racing. You know, you might see a handful, but if you go to a drag racetrack, like on a test and tune night, it looks just like you see the world looks. It's got color everywhere. You get what I mean? Like, from every race, culture, everything's out there. You know what I mean? And people always thought, like, they always classify drag racing as being like circle track racing. And it's not. It's like, my dad was drag racing before I was born in out of Chesterfield, New Jersey, and all of his friends from Philly, New York, they all had drag cars because they used to soup up their little Camaros, their Mustangs, all that stuff, and they'll take it to the drag strip and they'll race it. The pro rank's a little different because it takes money to get there. So that's what we need to do, is just open them gates and give more opportunity to have a little bit more diversity. But the thing about it is, we got to let them know about the opportunity.
Well, it sounds like I need to educate myself about the history of the sport too.
You got to remember, drag racing was the street racing culture coming there. Circle track racing was like those dirt track guys at dirt track down there in the South around deals that came in there, where that wasn't everywhere. Mm-hmm. Now that's getting everywhere. It's getting all over the place. But drag racing's always been there. Mm-hmm. It was always a very diverse sport. It was just needed somebody to tell a story.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a good job. Well, I've had you for too long. Thank you so much for illuminating both, you know, the sport for me and for your position in it and what you're planning on doing.
Oh, anytime. Well, thanks for having me on.
My thanks again to Antron Brown. IBJ profiled Antron in the June 25th issue, and you can find that story with a quick search at IBJ.com. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest issue that I want to draw to your attention. First up, Mickey Shuey dives into Indy's strategy to hold the line after the city's current contract to host the NFL Scouting Combine expires. Indianapolis has hosted the high-profile camp for decades, but the league recently put it out for bids from other cities. Also in this week's issue, Walker Simmons reports that Wheeler Mission is set to open an expanded center for homeless women and children that will nearly double the space available for services, add 160 short and long-term beds, and enhance addiction treatment and education programming. And Leslie Bonilla explains how a city proposal to require tracking of municipal and commercial energy use has the potential to help save millions of dollars, reduce emissions by thousands of tons, and cut water use by millions of gallons in less than a decade. Again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.